He was carrying this Victorian walking cane, and he sort of swished it around in my face, and it had got a... When you pulled it, there was a blade inside there, like a 3-foot-long blade that was secreted inside the top of the cane. And he whisked this blade out, swished it around, and brought it to a stop about an inch from my eyeball, and told me that I'd got 60 minutes.
Well, that is one way to be introduced to John Mellencamp. That's Paul Rees, the author of a brand new biography about Mellencamp called Mellencamp. And we will get to our rock conversation with Paul in a matter of minutes. What a fascinating book. And when I got to reading it and thinking more about its subject, I marveled at what a fascinating individual John Mellencamp really is. You know, for years, I think I'm like many of you. When I think of Mellencamp, I often think of the pop tunes, Pink Houses, Small Town, Jack and Diane. Great songs, but arguably overplayed in our lifetime to the point where I'm like, I don't need to hear it again. But then I think to the other tunes, the so many other tunes that Mellencamp has written and sung over the years. And I think, man, what an artist, what a singer-songwriter. And it amazes me how many of his songs continue to resonate when I hear them today. So we will talk about Mellencamp. Paul Rees, the author, has also written books about Robert Plant and John Entwistle. We'll talk about those two dudes as well. I mean, you could do much worse than John Mellencamp, Robert Plant, and John Entwistle. And Paul has some great stories about all three of them. Rock Conversations, I'm your host, Rob Bob, the self-proclaimed patriarch of rock. And before we get to our conversation with Paul Rees, let me remind you that you can pick up Rock Conversations wherever you get your podcasts. iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, you name it. And we do ask that you not only subscribe to us, but that you share a review from time to time. If you like it, and you know, even if you don't like it, I have thick skin. You know, I'm laughing because I've been known to be one of the most mellow individuals ever. Just ask anyone who knows me, my wife, my boys, I'm as mellow as they come. To paraphrase or to quote a Mellencamp album name, I'm Mr. Happy-Go-Lucky. Okay, I'm completely full of crap, all right? So I get a little bent out of shape over things from time to time. I like to enter some verbal warfare from time to time, much like, I realize, John Mellencamp does himself. So that's why I say, if you don't like us, you can put a nasty review. You can tell me how crappy you think I sound as an interviewer. Hey, bring it on. But you can also tell me how great you think I am. I can take that too. All right, with all that self-indulgence aside, let's get to our rock conversation with Paul Rees.
Oh, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back again.
I got to thinking as I was reading your book, entitled Mellencamp, fittingly enough, that I have followed John Mellencamp's career almost from its infancy and maybe have not appreciated his talent enough. Do you think in the American specter, at least, when it comes to rock and roll singer-songwriters, is he one of our most undervalued treasures?
I think it's a great question. Absolutely. Yeah, I think that was part of the appeal to me in doing a book on him, telling the story, that I think he's massively undervalued. And I would question whether there's a big body of people who will probably know him from the one song or possibly Small Town and that 80s era, who would have absolutely no idea of the trajectory after that and the people he's worked with, the people he's heralded by. And it's even more demonstrably true in the UK, you know, that he's barely acknowledged in the UK post Jack and Diane.
Well, it's interesting you bring up those songs. You know, when most people think of Mellencamp, they think of Jack and Diane, Pink Houses, and probably Small Town. All yeah. Iconic songs, but arguably all overplayed, to the point where, you know, you almost don't appreciate the greatness of them. And because of that, you kind of lose track of what he did on either side of those songs.
He did, I think it's particularly after, I think if you do yourself a Mellencamp playlist and work through, even if you just work through from Jack and Diane what's up to the present day, the distance travel, both in terms of what he was writing about, the style of music. I mean, I think he's pretty much ended up as a great American folk artist, certainly in the last 10, 15 years that he's been writing. And it's a journey that's up there with the likes of the latter period of Johnny Cash's work. You think about that he's almost had some of his best and most interesting work has been made once he got into his late 50s, and now he's 70 years old. He's still making great music.
I found it very interesting and maybe fitting, particularly as I read the book, that I think one of his daughters called him colorful. And I thought, what a great word to use to describe John Mellencamp. He is certainly, if nothing else, colorful.
I think that's a description loaded with meaning. Colorful. I think he described himself as that. He certainly is that. I think the first time I met him, I write about it in the book. I went out to Bloomington to interview him, and he came. It was on his property. So he's got a big art studio on his property, which is about half a mile up the track from his house. And I was waiting for him there, and he roared up on this tiny little John Deere tractor, got out the tractor, and he's not what you'd call a tall man, but he's got a huge pompadour of hair.
Yeah,
and he was carrying this Victorian walking cane. And he sort of swished it around in my face, and it had got a. When you pulled it, there was a blade inside there, like a 3 foot long blade that was secreted inside the top of the cane. And he whisked this blade out, swished it around, and brought it to a stop about an inch from my eyeball, and told me in so many words that I'd got 60 minutes. And he's quite a intimidating, imposing character until you actually get beyond that. I think he's very much aware of people's perception of him. I think he very much plays up to a role. But he reminded me of a character out of American fiction. He's someone you can imagine Faulkner might have created back in the day. Or Jonathan France. Now he's that sort of, one of the, just running a fat scion of a family, interesting character, has his moods, likes doing things his own way, walks the beat of his own drum.
Yeah, if he ever, if I were ever in that position, which I doubt I will be, to meet him and he pulled out a little knife and said 60 minutes, I think he's telling me more than we're limited to 60 minutes. It's like, you better get this interview correct.
Well, I wish it was a knife. It was about a 3 foot long blade that made it even more intimate. I think part of that, I think he's, once he knew that I actually was aware of his career and that I could go back to, like you said, back to Giant Jack and Dan Beyond that, and was actually interested in talking to him. It was interested in what he'd got to say, and that he wasn't going to be asked why was he called Cougar and tell me about Jack and Diane. He warmed up considerably. I think I ended up spending 3.5-4 hours with him, and he's a brilliant interview. But I think he's, like we started with, he's acutely aware of that sense. I think he wouldn't necessarily articulate to you, but he's, I think John bears a significant sense, not a chip on his shoulder, but he would like to be and feels he deserves to be more recognized than he is and respected more than he is, I think, as a songwriter.
I want to get back to that later in our interview, talking about him again as a songwriter, but go back to something you said just a couple of minutes ago about how he's like a character out of American fiction. Is that something that comes natural to him, or is he one of these artists who kind of creates a persona for the public and for the media and for others?
I think that's there's quite two or three of the people I interviewed made the same point, and they said that the one thing that you get with him is he's totally authentic.
Good. I mean, that's what I wanted to hear.
Yeah, he is who he is. There are no. I don't think John's playing any kind of role. I think that's part of the reason he's so frustrated, annoyed, that he was called Cougar and he had to carry, because he's John Mellencamp. That's his given name. And he's very much, he's exact, what you see is what you get. You know, he doesn't varnish it. He doesn't pretend to be someone else, warts and all. So no, I don't think John Mellencamp is any kind of construct. It's he wears his heart on his sleeve and he is who he is.
Paul Reese is our guest. He is the author of the new book, Mellencamp, among other titles that you've written. We'll talk about some of those a little later. It's an incredible book. What struck me as strange, maybe not strange, because I know a lot of artists will look back at their early works and kind of like shrug their shoulders and say, okay, that's what I did then. It wasn't as good. I actually really like some of his first quote unquote hits or the songs that got record play. he kind of turned his nose to some of those songs like, you know, This Time and Ain't Even Done With the Night. I think those hold their own throughout the decades.
Yeah, I was surprised going back and listening to, because obviously I spent the last couple of years listening to far too much Mellencamp than is healthy for anybody. But I,
as long as you weren't smoking along, you know, as many cigarettes as he smokes while you were listening to those.
I don't think I'd be here if I had been. But I was surprised how much I enjoyed listening back to those records. I think in John's perception of them is obviously he was critically either ignored or reviled to an extent, certainly with the first two or three records he made. And I think he measures it. I think he's always, he wouldn't, I don't think he'd specify this, but I think he's measured himself against the likes of Petty and Springsteen and Bob Seger and that thing. So he always felt, he felt he was running to catch up. And I don't think he believed he'd caught up until he got to Scarecrow and Lonesome Jubilee and that sort of point. So I think he has a fairly dismissive view of those records.
Did you get the feeling in talking to him and talking to others near him that there have been moments where he's been, dare I say, happy with his career? Or is he always kind of dealing with that inner angst, inner anguish, and maybe that's what drives him?
That's a great question. Because the thing I asked a lot of people, most of the people I interviewed for the book, the last thing I asked them was, if you could ask him one question, what would it be? And I did about 40, 50, 60 interviews for the book, and 95% of them answered, I'd ask him if he was happy, because I've no idea. And I'm not sure, I am pretty sure actually, I don't think he's ever sat back and been content. I think that's part of why he continues to make great music. I think he remains one of those classic artistic things he's always trying to do himself. He still firmly believes he hasn't yet made his best record or his greatest song. And I think it's a constant quest to do that or paint his best painting. I don't think, certainly not in his professional life, I don't think he's ever been satisfied. I think it's part of what has driven him, part of what's made him difficult to make, quote unquote, to make records with. If you're a band member or a producer or engineer, he's striving for something that he probably never feels he's quite got to.
And for those who don't know, and I'm not sure I did, if I did, I forgot it, I'll be honest. Your reference to not having done his best painting is not a metaphor. He's actually a very accomplished artist.
Yeah, I hesitate to say he's not Bob Dylan or Ronnie Wood when it comes to art, but he's not your classic rock star dabbler in painting. He's you know, from a very young age, he was interested in painting. His mom painted to a certain level. He's gone and studied, and he's been properly exhibited. You know, the last exhibition he had in New York was alongside Robert Rauschenberg, who's one of those great American expressionist painters. And I think he's worked a way towards being seen that he can stand shoulder to shoulder with what you'd call proper artists. His art's really good. I mean, and he takes it very seriously. He probably devotes more time to it than anything else. But you know, he's properly art dealt on those markets, and he's properly exhibited now in that respect.
There's a story in your book about how he and Dylan got together to discuss art, and Dylan actually gave him some tips. I'm going to let you pick up on that story.
Yeah, I think John initially was very much painting for himself, and I think acutely sensitive about that very fact we've mentioned about being seen as the rock star artist. He'd had an early exhibition with he and Miles Davis were exhibited alongside each other at a gallery in Los Angeles in Beverly Hills, and the people responsible for the billboard up on Sunset Strip, and he took great exception to it being his art being sold on the back of him being a rock star, which obviously it's hard to avoid that. But Dylan went to stay with him and saw the work he got around the place, and John was saying, you know, I'm not really interested in selling it and all the rest of it. And Dylan was like, you know, I sell mine. What? There's nothing to apologise about it. Dylan passed him on the an art dealer and pretty much hooked him up in that respect and said, you know, it's good, mate. The most of it. There's nothing to be. I think Dylan's been sort of sage-like in that respect for John, because John respects Dylan. He did it in the sense of, you know, John did a Chevrolet ad for the track One Country. Our country, and he'd never put his music out for license. And he was talking to that about to Dylan as well. And Dylan just said, why do you care what anybody else says? Just and I think that's, I think if you're going to get advice, Dylan's not a bad person to take it from. And I don't think there's too many people he would take advice from.
No, it seems that Dylan, the way you encapsulate it, knows not only art, but knows money. And he's not afraid to, as you just alluded to, kind of meld the two.
Well, I think from Dylan's point of view is, that, you know, there's a value in what you do. So you shouldn't be embarrassed or apologetic about realizing the value in that. And if you're going to paint and you want to do it seriously, then do it to a professional level. Don't do it as something, stick them in the back of a room or hang them in your own house. And I think from Dylan saying that, it almost makes it, I think it made him feel more comfortable about venturing out into that world and not being fearful of being tarred with that rock star painter brush, so to speak.
On Rock Conversations, we're speaking with Paul Reese. He is the author of the new book, Mellencamp. As we get closer to the holiday season, hint, hint, it would be a great gift for your loved one or your friends, or even if you want to give something to your enemy, it's still a good book. Let's talk about the Midwest. I have lived in the Midwest. I was thinking during this interview, not that it takes too long of a thought process. I have lived in the Midwest my entire life, most of which has been in Minnesota, 4 years in Indiana, and a short respite in Chicago, Illinois. How much, it's kind of a weird question because there's so much to say about it, but how much does Mellencamp's Midwest upbringing impact him as a person and his music?
I think it's that classic cliche stick of rock thing. If you snapped him open, I think Midwest would run through him. I think, you know, he's remained embedded in the Midwest. He continues to live there. He's got a house now in New York and a place in Carolina out on the coast. But I think he identifies very, very strongly with Indiana. He's written about all the way through his career, I think that sort of all of his writing has been informed by where he's come from and who he is. And you know, from Jack and Diane, what's Jack and Diane, you know, it's a classic high school football story, but it's he was a high school football player in the Midwest. So I think everything he writes about is based in that Miley, that's where he sees himself. I'm struggling to remember any song that he would have written that was about hanging out in Hollywood or, you know, rock and rolling all night in New York. It's all pretty much about, he does that classic thing. He writes about what he knows and what
right.
he sees.
Yeah. You don't think of the Sunset Strip when you hear Rain on the Scarecrow, do you?
Absolutely not.
You either quote him or you write about this, that, you know, he's rooted in these, what I would consider almost conservative Midwest values. Yet, and I don't want to get into too much of an overt political discussion, yet I think he says he's about as liberal as they come. And what amazes me is that he's been able to combine the two, the values of the Midwest, arguably conservative, with liberal politics, without getting in people's face too much to the point of being annoying. I mean, we saw his involvement with Farm Aid. I mean, imagine that, having an opportunity, especially with the initial one in Champaign-Urbana, to participate in something that, you know, was set up to do so much good for so many people. And that's, I think, one of the joys of Mellencamp and one of the things I've always admired about him, that he could find that balance of conservative Midwest values and, dare I say, liberal politics.
Yeah, I think he's struck that balance really well. I mean, the Farm Aid thing goes pretty much relates back to the previous question, how much the Midwest informed him. You know, Rain and the Scarecrow came from a conversation he was having around the kitchen table with George Green, who you know, he went to high school with and wrote several lyrics for him. They had this interesting collaboration where George would write lyrics and John would send them to music on certain songs. And it was a conversation on the kitchen table one night in John's house about how so many small town farmers in their area, immediate area, were being foreclosed or were struggling. John's sister was married to a farmer. And so he wrote the song about it. Willie Nelson heard it or was tipped off to it when Willie Nelson started Farm Aid, invited John along in 1985. And both of them are still board members of Farm Aid and have, you know, have put themselves where the mouths are, if that makes sense. You know, they've gone along, sure. done those gigs. He's done TV appearances. He went and spoke. I think it was a congressional subcommittee where he turned up with Willie Nelson. They appeared before that, appealing during the time of Reagan for investment and help for American small town farmers. Pretty much, every now and again, he did a song. He did a covers album of old blues songs, and he did a song called To Washington, which was an old Woody Guthrie song that he reinterpreted around the time of the Second Gulf War. That caused a bit of consternation, I think, not just in the Midwest, but elsewhere. He told me he had people pulling up on the Lake Monroe, where he lives, outside his house, shouting abuse at him from their boats and stuff like that. But you can't engage in that sort of arena without upsetting someone. But I think he's done it with a gentle touch, but I think he's also done it because it's fairly obviously sincere about what he writes, but he doesn't grandstand for the sake of it.
We are speaking with Paul Rees, the author of the new book, Mellencamp, but that is not your only book. So we'll get back to John in just a little bit, but let's talk a little bit about some of the other artists who you've covered throughout your career, either for stories or for other books. Robert Plant. I don't know where to start with questions about Robert Plant because he's such a huge rock and roll figure. So why don't you tell me what you expected to find out when you started researching your book on Robert Plant?
I think it's more than you hope to find out, because I think there'd obviously been quite a few Zeppelin books. Hammer of the Gods obviously been the most infamous and notorious, but there's a sort of mythology around Zeppelin that it's almost impossible to escape. What I hope to find out, because I grew up in exactly... Robert Plant grew up 5 miles down the road from where my parents live. I know a place called Stourbridge where he grew up, and I know all the things that whole area really, really well. I know the Black Country really well. What I hoped to find was something that took him back to those roots and where he'd come from, and how that, exactly like we just said with John, how that informed him going forward and what part that played in making him. And I think I did. I was fortunate to see, he was very gracious. He let me speak to people he'd been friends with from his school days and from early on and from art college and stuff like that. So I did get a real sense of an actual person beyond the golden god, which was, I think, important.
With Robert or other members of Zeppelin, they started, I think it's fair to say, as essentially a rock and blues band, and evolved into rock deities. You think they ever expected to hit where they did, with albums 2, 3, and then, of course, 4?
I don't think Robert did. I think, Jimmy Page is slightly different, John Paul Jones, because they were career musicians. I think by that point, for them, certainly, there was a notion that you could have a career playing music. Jimmy had obviously been through the Yardbirds, John Paul Jones was playing sessions, but I think they had a notion that this was a career. I think one of the things that slightly took me aback when I was writing the book is there's a point in I think it's 1968, where Robert has been playing around bands where he grew up in the Midlands, West Midlands of England, where he grew up for 2, 3, 4 years without really getting anywhere. And he's got a job laying tarmac, or asphalt, as you probably couldn't say, on roads for the council, the local government in West Bromwich, where he lived. And 18 months later, he's 19 years old, and 18 months later, they've made Led Zeppelin 2 and they're the biggest band in the world. The speed of that journey is a staggering thing. I don't think in any way, shape or form possible that he could have imagined that he would go from laying tarmac to being the biggest rock star on the planet within 18 months.
And I don't think anyone can really prepare you for that. Even those who've gone through it, I don't think can offer too many. They can offer some words of advice, but I mean, that's meteoric. And then you are at the pinnacle.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the point of all those books about Zeppelin, and where in some ways I think the Plant story is more interesting, the before and after, because the Zeppelin, that meteoric thing, and it really was, it was 10 years. It's 10 years out of someone's life who's now in his mid-70s. And it obviously, it, you can't help but be changed by that. In the middle of that whirlwind, it's almost impossible for any of, you know, quote unquote normal person to imagine how that shapes you, how that changes you. But where he goes after that and what he does after that, I think is really interesting. And to, the other thing that I think plants enormous credit is that he hasn't hung his hat to a massive extent on harking back to former glories. He's one of those guys that's been, like Mellencamp, he's been really curious, continued to be curious, continued to want to stretch himself musically and go down different avenues and explore different things without singing Stairway to Heaven every night.
It was interesting because I think his first solo album, help me out here, was it not Pictures at an Exhibition, Pictures at 11? Gosh, I can't even remember.
Pictures at 11, then Principle of Moments.
The first one, it sounded like basically a continuation of Zeppelin. And I think Zeppelin fans kind of liked it. But when he came out with the Principle of Moments, I bought that on cassette. Kind of dating myself here. Okay. And I played it over and over. I thought, this is fascinating. You know, this is not the Robert Plant that I grew up listening to on Zeppelin vinyl. I mean, this is a different, he still had the pipes, obviously, but this was a different style of music, different style of rock and roll, and it worked, and it worked well.
Yeah, I think he's done that. He's done that all the way. The album he made after that, Shaken and Stirred, I mean, he took a critical battering for that record because it was pretty much, he made an electronic pop album. There were next to, the Robbie Blunt was on it, but it was synthesized guitars. And he's gone off then various routes thereafter. You know, he's dabbled in all sorts of things, some more successful than others. But, you know, later period, I think he's almost worked his way back to where he started.
Yeah.
Which was someone who sang folk and blues. He got back to that point and has done it in a way that's really interesting. You know, certainly the first record with Alison Krauss was a terrific record. The band he's had, he's brought in world music elements. He's done really interesting covers. He's a guy, and I think he's got comfortable with the fact that he makes music purely for himself. And if you like it, great. If you don't, he's going to carry on doing it.
What I loved back in the, what I'd call the heyday of his solo career, I think it's fair to call it the heyday, because we focus on this podcast, not only on authors and critics, but also DJs from what I call the halcyon days of rock and roll radio, the 70s and the 80s. And back then they were still playing new music when it was new. And it was kind of fun to be exposed to Robert Plant's solo music, even if you say accurately that it might've been a little deviation from rock and roll. But these stations were so, you know, like, he's Plant, we got to play him. And I like that because it exposed us as listeners to different forms of Robert Plant. We're talking with Paul Reese. He is the author, among other things, of the new book on John Mellencamp. He also wrote a book about Robert Plant, who we just discussed. And then there's one about John Entwistle. How can anyone leave out John Entwistle when talking about the great bassist of all time?
I think the John Entwistle one is another one of those, one of the all-time great characters in music. And that thing about bands being incredible, you know, if you think about Zeppelin, without any one of those elements in the band, not the same band. And The Who, very much the same. I found it interesting that everybody in The Who, bar John Entwistle, had been written about in book form or otherwise. And the thought that there had to be an interesting story to tell about John. And it was much more than that. I think it was an interesting story. It's quite a tragic story. Fascinating guy. And again, without him, and without Moon, The Who aren't The Who. I don't think it's the same band. I think it totally changes the dynamic. But yeah, one of those, I mean, you have to be careful because obviously trying to measure people by different areas and the way they behave. But as a rock star of that era, he pretty much embodies everything that a rock star is in that era, good and otherwise.
Yeah. I mean, whether he came up with the lines or had some help from Pete, you know, like the start of Real Me or The Real Me. I mean, when you hear that bass, it's like, wow. Or Boris the Spider. I mean, I could go on and on. But, you know, I think as listeners, we're sometimes so fixated on Daltrey's voice or maybe the overall song quality that Townsend put together generally. You know, there were other songs written by others. You sometimes lose track of the bass line, which, as you say, without his bass line, they're not The Who.
Well, they're not. And he does two really fascinating things in The Who, because obviously with Keith Moon in the band, they have a drummer who had an erratic concept of timekeeping, barely bothered with it, but was phenomenal. So he has to do the job of keeping the time and literally the anchor to keep the band from going off in an insane direction. And then because Townsend's playing is very much, you know, great slashing chords, there's that whole space there as well for the bass to become something completely different. I mean, he's almost a lead guitarist playing bass.
Exactly.
Times.
Yeah. Yeah. And visually, you know, to see him on stage, the way he's almost plucking it effortlessly, you know, yeah. There were times where he's like, I don't want to say he was a robot because he wasn't playing like a robot, but it's like, come on, John, can you move a little bit? Come on, let's see. You know, it was graceful, yet at the same time, it almost looked homogenous.
But I think that was the fascinating thing about him, that his personality was entirely reflective of his playing and his the way he was on stage. So in the notion that he was quite steadfast, he was a very stoic, quite taciturn man at times. And then with the flamboyance of his bass, he's the member of the Who who goes off and buys the massive mansion and the Rolls Royces.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's probably leads the most extraordinary sort of unmoored lifestyle of any of them. You know, he spent money like it was water. He's a fascinating character. He's literally two polar opposites as a person as well. And the one who was having done all that would then go home and want to sit and read the paper and do a bit of, and you know, eat fish and chips. You know, he's a very normal man who had extraordinary abnormal appetites.
Down to the very end, right? I think I think he passed with a little cocaine and maybe a hired escort in Vegas, if I recall, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the woman he spent it on, he did know. I think she was an exotic dancer, to use the phrase, and he'd had a dalliance or knew her well before. But yeah, he went out. John was another one who literally lived his life exactly the way he wanted to live it. And nobody was going to divert him from that. You know, he had advice from accountants and all the rest of it about you might want to look after your money.
Yeah.
You might not. There's a brilliant story when him and his wife, they go off, his wife at the time, Alison, who was his first wife, they go off looking for what they imagine, or she imagines, is a tiny little country cottage where when they're out of London, they can go. And he comes back with a 60 plus room mansion. Which is his idea of a country cottage, which is ruinously expensive, but he wanted it, so he had it. And he, you know, all those numerous cars, he had a fleet of cars and never bothered learning to drive.
Well, that's one way to collect them, I guess. Keep the mileage low. We are talking with Paul Rees, who's authored a number of books, including, as we just mentioned, one on John Entwistle, another one on Robert Plant. And let's get back to our main reason for talking today, and that's your new book about John Mellencamp. The smoking has always amazed me. I think you said at one point it was four packs a day. How does anyone have the time to smoke four packs a day? What is that? I'm not a smoker. 80 cigarettes, 20 per pack, something like that?
Yeah.
Reminds me of an interview. For some reason, I was listening to it. It's an older one from like 85. Studs Terkel. In Chicago, talking to Leonard Bernstein. And if you listen closely, obviously a different day and age where you could smoke in the studio, every 3 or 4 minutes, you could hear the sound of a match being lit and Leonard Bernstein lighting up again. Caught up with him, obviously. With Mellencamp, I mean, I found interesting, I did not know this, that he basically swore off booze and alcohol early in life and just kind of stuck to cigarettes. How does he survive? That's what I want to know.
Well, he did have a heart attack in his 40s, which I think was not only the fact that he was smoking 80 cigarettes a day, but also existing on a diet of fast food and with epic stress levels, self-induced stress levels by, you know, being quite a highly strung character, to put it mildly. Yeah. But the first time I interviewed him, we were talking about, I'd asked him about the heart attack, and he spent an awful lot of time telling me about how it happened, how it felt, the aftermath of it. And all the while he's telling the story, he's taking the cigarette out of the packet, he's taking off the filter, he's stamping it down to get the tobacco back inside where he's ripped the filter off. He's lighting a cigarette. And then in answer to your question how people can smoke that many cigarettes in one go, he literally takes it down from top to nib in one massively deep breath, and then he repeats the process. And he probably had two or three, four cigarettes in just the time he's telling me this one anecdote. And I said to him, he was saying, you know, I changed my diet, I started to exercise daily. I tried to calm down. So I've done everything I could possibly do, followed advice, not to have another heart attack. And I said to him, well, did they mention anything about those? And he went, yeah, that was the bit I wasn't going to give up. And I think he's cussedly said he will be a lifelong smoker. And he did say, he said, I know they'll get me in the end, but I've squared myself with that.
At least he's honest with himself, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
I remember I've only seen him in concert once, but I do remember vividly him smoking on stage in a no-smoking arena. And while I'm not a fan of cigarette smoke, there are times where I love the defiance of anti-smoking laws. You know, there's kind of the rebel in me that says, and I looked down at him, I thought, you go, man. We're here to see you, and you're going to do what you want to do, even if it means defying a city ordinance.
Yeah, there's a story in the book, Nora Guthrie, Woody Guthrie's story. I can't remember, I think it was the Pete Seeger 90th birthday concert at Madison Square Garden. And she said she wandered backstage and John was stood up underneath an enormous no smoking sign, having a cigarette. And it's kind of what you want, John. You'd be very upset if John had put his cigarette out upon seeing him. You want John Mellencamp to be standing smoking under a no smoking sign, because that's pretty much embodies everything about him.
I don't want to get too tabloidish, but I do want to touch upon John and his girlfriends and his wives. He's had many of them, some very famous. Elaine, the model, Meg Ryan, on and off. What is it about his personality, do you think, that has either that appetite or inability to settle down with just one woman?
I think there's multiple things. I think to start with, the whole lifestyle of being in the music business, certainly through when John was hugely successful and the demands upon touring makes any kind of normal relationship difficult. He said to me, he quotes, I can't remember the exact figure, but he said he sat down at one point and realised in the preceding 2 years he'd been at home for something like 31 days. And that makes any kind of normal family life extraordinarily difficult. So I think that probably accounts for the second marriage to Victoria Granucci. I think his first marriage, they married very, very young. He eloped essentially to get married at I think he's 19, 17, 18, 19 years old. He was a teenager when he got married. And that, trying to survive that while you're trying to make it as a rock star is difficult. John, I think he says it's part of his own personality. He always says, I've always found it difficult to play with the other kids. So he's very much set in his ways. He's very much does things his own way. He does enjoy his own company. I would guess that's made it difficult. And latterly, I spoke to a couple of people, friends of his, in relation to Meg Ryan. And they said, John and Meg Ryan as well, have reached an age in life where they're so used to doing things their own way and living the life that they've made for themselves. It makes it incredibly difficult for them to cohabit or continue in an extended relationship with someone because they're so set in their ways. I think he's just one of those, I think he's quite an ordinary character. I think he's probably, you know, he's a man who gets up in the morning and goes off and spends 12 hours in his art studio without talking to someone. I think that might have made cohabiting quite difficult.
Now, I'm not going to compare my talents because they don't even compare to his talents. But as I was reading the book, I thought, okay, I see some resemblance. I can be a little ornery. I can drive people pretty hard. And that's not always a bad thing. I don't think the people on the other end always appreciate it. You talk about how he was a taskmaster when it came to the studio and performing live. And he generally got what he wanted, but maybe not always on the most peaceful terms. Talk a little bit about his relationship with his stable of musicians that generally were with him throughout the majority of his career.
Yeah, and I think that you have to balance that because he does have a reputation, rightly so, for being highly strung, I said, quite volatile. But there are Mike Wanchick being the prime example. Mike Wanchick's been with him almost since day one and still plays in his band. Most of the people who have been in his bands have had 10 years that have lasted 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 years. But pretty much all of them could tell you a story, multiple stories about being on the wrong end of his temper. sometime on the wrong end of his fists and tongue lashings and all the rest of it. Kenny Aronoff, who was drummer from mid-80s right the way through to the, I think he ended up in late 1990s, so he had 10, 12 years with him. He liked working with John to go into Vietnam on a daily basis, which I think about covers it. And the band will tell you that the people who were in his band at any point will tell you that that they rehearsed both to make records and to tour almost like they were a sports team. It was like going into training for a sports team. It would be to the nth degree. They were rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed. And he would literally run around on stage if someone was standing still or was not in, and Hector and Barrage. And he was pretty much the same in the studio. I think at the end of the day, it's his name above the door. And I think he cares deeply about how he's perceived and about wanting to get exactly what he hears. And he said he's not a particularly brilliant musician. He's a great songwriter, but not a great musician. He can't read music. But getting out what he hears in his head onto tape, I think, isn't the easiest process for him or anybody else around him.
Let's talk about how he's perceived. You talked earlier about how he measures himself against the likes of Tom Petty, Bruce Springsteen, maybe Dylan, maybe even Bob Seger, another fellow Midwesterner. What do they think? What do you think those musicians think of John Mellencamp's work?
Well, Dylan, so he's obviously toured twice with Dylan. They went and did one summer tour. I think around about 2009, and then 2010 consecutive summers they went out together. And Dylan, accepting a songwriting award, stood up and mentioned a song called "Longest Days" that John had written as being a song that he loved. And Dylan doesn't really tend to bestow praise easily on his contemporaries. So the endorsement of Dylan is quite a big thing. Johnny Cash, there's a guy called David Rowe who was bass player in Cash's band, and he played with Mellencamp. And John had played with Cash. He'd written songs with the intention of Cash using them. And David Rowe said Cash was of the opinion that John was one of the greatest living American songwriters.
Interesting.
Which I think is pretty high praise. And then with regard to Springsteen,
but maybe not. But let me interject just for a second, if I could. Cash may not have thought him to be the best rehearser. They had that little snafu where I'll let you tell the story. They were going to do a duet, and maybe it didn't go quite as planned.
Yeah, they were doing the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame concert, and Cash invited John up because John had sent Cash a song that Cash didn't end up using. A song called "Something Around the Moon," and John. He invited John to get up and duet with him. John's band were playing the concert, Cash was. So he invites John to get up and duet with him. I can't remember. I think it might have been Ring of Fire, the song they were doing. Cash pops into John's dress or concert song and says, we should sound check the song together, do a little run through of it. And John's like, nah, I know the song, I'm fine, I'll wing it. And John had forgotten to note that Cash, in his later years, had dropped the pitch of his voice by several octaves.
Yeah.
So they get up to start singing, and John's singing at a completely different pitch to Cash, and then he's trying mid-verse to come down to where Cash, and John can't get down to where Cash is. So they basically send like two drunken men singing a sea shanty whilst wandering home from the bar. And afterwards, I think Cash paid a visit to John's dressing room. He just opened the door and he just said, yeah, told you to the sound check. And that was literally all he said. So I think that was, John said he could feel himself getting hotter under the collar and shrinking the longer that song went on. It was one of the most painful things he ever endured. But Cash had a very high opinion of him. And then Springsteen, John's making a record at the moment. He's got a new record coming and Springsteen plays on the record, sings on
really?
The record.
Great.
Yeah, they've worked together. So I think there was talk in the ether that they might end up collaborating further on something else, whether that's a more extended collaboration or in something Bruce, but they're certainly working together. So I think he's held in very high regard. I think they see him as, he's a peer to those guys. I think that there's a mutual respect thing there, definitely.
And well-deserved. I think if the boss is willing to collaborate with you, I think it's pretty evident that he respects your musical talents.
Yeah, I don't think Bruce is doing it as a favour. I think Bruce works with people he admires and he likes, and John would be one of those people, for sure.
In the final few minutes we have left, I want to address two things. We're talking, by the way, with Paul Reiss. He's the author of the brand new book, Mellencamp. There's one song that you write about that, for certain reasons, has always stuck with me. It's Jackie Brown. I remember one of the first times I heard it. I was driving to visit my grandma. She was in the hospital. Heard it on the loop in Chicago, Loop FM 98. And it just stuck, all that kind of together. Such a beautiful song, yet kind of a tragic song. And still, I think, one of the best he's ever written. I want your thoughts, and maybe you could share his thoughts as well, on Jackie Brown, the song.
I think it's, there's a, I spoke to a guy called Bob Guccione Jr. for the book. Bob used to edit Spin magazine in the States. And Bob said if Dylan had written that song, it would be Garland is one of the all-time great American songs. And it is a remarkable song. He made it for a record called Big Daddy. He describes it as having got to the top with Scarecrow and Lonesome Jubilee, looked up, they didn't like what he sees, and he decides to go and make a really downbeat record virtually on his own. It's one of the things he does really well. He writes a character sketch about a black, poor black guy, down from the black guy, reflecting on his life and his family, largely an acoustic song. And it's just he's a really underrated lyricist as well, because there's something almost like it's like a short story in three or four verses that tells
Absolutely.
You a moving, evocative, poetic story about someone and creates a character, a sketch of a character that you implicitly understand the guy he's writing about and the life he's had. And he steps himself into that guy's shoes. It's a great, great song. He still will play it now and again and bring it out and play it. But I think he knows, I think you talked to John about it, I think he thinks that's one of the songs where he got it absolutely right. And he doesn't feel that very often, but I think that's one of those songs that he wouldn't change a note on.
So here's a true confession. I heard that I was probably a sophomore or junior in college. And at the time, I thought I could play guitar and sing live. Okay. That's a big difference than actually doing. It was okay. I did all right. And I thought, well, I'll learn this song and play it. You know, and I'm reminded of a Mellencamp lyric. What is it? A band crucifying John Lennon, cover band. And I crucified the song Jackie Brown. I just have to make that full confession, as much as I love it. Final question. I know when you research a book like this, you have a lot of things you expect to learn, but then there are things that you don't expect to learn. I'm wondering if there was one anecdote or something similar that you learned from talking with John or those around him that kind of blew you away, that you never expected to hear.
Oh, that's put me on the spot.
I'm the master of unfair questions, you know.
Yeah, I'm racing through my memory banks to think of the thing that I think is sensitivity. I know it sounds very, very boring, but there's a guy called Harry Sandler who was his tour manager for a long time and his great friend. And I spoke to Deborah, Harry's partner, and she was saying when Harry passed, John, because he does a bit of woodworking. He made a piece of woodwork, a carving with a note on it, and he sent it to her. And he'd written a really long note, expressing, you know, what he felt about Harry. And I think that's the thing. There are other people in the book in similar situations that I spoke to who said that. John would be on the phone and he would know and he would remember. And someone else I entered the book whose mother was terminally ill in hospital, and John called her in hospital. Didn't need to, didn't tell the guy that he had called her, he just did it. I think he's one of those people that, you know, John's a rock star. They don't really walk among us the same way that we do. But I think it's about as closely as you can be plugged back into just being a genuine person, I think he is. And that's, I think, the thing that it didn't surprise me, but I think it was in amongst all the stories of him ranting, raving and swinging at people, that underneath it, I think there's a there's a sensitive and a good soul as well, which I think was it makes 2 years research feel worthwhile when you get to that point.
He is Paul Reese, and he is the author of an exceptional book, Mellencamp. Thank you so much for taking time to join us today on Rock Conversations.
Thank you in return for having me. It's been a real pleasure.